sunny and 83. Then the weekend cools off again. Saturday, partly sunny and 68. Sunday, partly sunny and 62. Right now, wind is calm. The sun is shining. 50 degrees Kenosha, 51 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Twelve minutes after 8 o'clock, here on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. At a recent Fine Arts and Humanities Division meeting, a faculty colleague, John Bruning, got up and announced a screening of a film on the campus of Carthage College on Friday evening, October 11th. A screening of what sounds to be a absolutely fascinating film, at least at the time I assumed it to be, and of course have since then had a chance to watch this remarkable award-winning film called Don't Turn Your Back on Friday Night. It tells the story of a very, very talented and fascinating rock musician by the name of Ike Riley. And Ike Riley's connection here with southeastern Wisconsin is that all three of his sons have attended Carthage, and his youngest son, Mickey, is still a student at Carthage. And they are all going to be on hand for the screening of this film, which traces Ike Riley's really intriguing career in music over the last several decades. Someone who's had great, great gifts and yet never quite managed to break through into the full-fledged stardom that that a lot of people feel he deserves. But he has a very fervent, loyal fan base all across the country. And he has a lot to be proud of. And that really is the subject of this film, Don't Turn Your Back on Friday Night, which has garnered quite a few awards for those responsible for it, including my guest for part one of today's morning show, Michael Schmiedler, who is producer, co-director, and co-writer for this wonderful film that draws from a wealth of film footage from Ike Riley's long career to tell the story of his life and career in remarkably vivid fashion. A little bit later in the hour, we're going to actually have in our studios Ike Riley himself and two of his sons. But right now, we're spending a few minutes talking over the phone with Mike Schmiedler. Mike Schmiedler, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thanks so much for having me. Thanks for the kind words, and I'm so glad you enjoyed the film.
I really did. And I got to say, too, as most people listening to this show are well aware, I'm more of an opera string quartet kind of guy. So it's not that this film, you know, exactly hits me square in the heart. I mean, this is not my world in terms of the music I regularly listen to or know very much about. And yet I found myself absolutely captivated, just carried away by the story of Ike Riley and his family. And so my congratulations to you. How did this project come about, and how did your involvement in it come about?
Yeah, no, great, great question. And I met Ike Riley in 2011. A friend of mine, good friend. I'm a television producer. I've made a lot of television. That's what I've done my entire career, is really television and documentary. And a friend of mine who was an editor of mine was like, you know what, you got to come check this guy out. I think you would really like his music, and you'd like him a lot. And it was Ike Riley. Ike Riley Assassination was the band, and Michael O'Brien was my friend who was the editor. And so I went and saw him at Shuba's, a venue down in Chicago that I lived literally blocks away from. And I was blown away. I was like, how are these guys not huge? This music's amazing. Like, it's really, really good. It's clever. The storytelling and the music itself is just so different and unique. I was really impressed. And then I met Ike, and Michael O'Brien had edited some of his videos and some other things, and he is one of the most charismatic people on stage and on camera that you'll ever meet. Again, a great storyteller in his music, a great storyteller in life. Well, I stayed in touch with him. I went to see his shows, went to a lot of his home shows, stayed in touch. And then in 2018, I was at a show around Christmas with my brother, and during the show, I'm like, I should just do a documentary on him. I know we have all this footage because O'Brien's got all this stuff. And I had actually used him as talent in something I had pitched. I'm like, you know, we should just do a documentary. And that way it could be about him, about his story, and we could make it what we want. Well, I pitched him the idea, and he was kind of like, I'm not that interesting. What's your film about? Like, what, you know, I don't think this would be that amazing. And I'm like, I disagree. So I chased him down for about 8 or 9 months. And finally he's like, hey, if it'll help me and the band and get us some recognition, I'll do anything. Sure, fine. If you think it can be good, then I believe in you, and let's go. So then the irony was, anybody in independent filmmaking will tell you the hard part's getting the money. Well, I got money together in like 6 weeks because I found,
wow,
frankly, some benefactors who are friends of who are fans of his, I should say, fans of his, who have deep pockets, and they were 100% on board with what I was doing. They're like, yes, this is what we need to get the word out. So the irony was that I chased Ike for a long time, and then the money fell into place pretty quick. And then, you know, the pandemic kind of hit us in 2020, so we didn't get to do a ton of shooting then, but then really some shooting then. And we'd been shooting all along. That's the thing that I knew, is he'd been shooting, as you see in the doc, his whole life. So there's all this archive. And so we used COVID for O'Brien to really go through the archive. And then in 2021, did a lot of shooting, edited in 2022. 2023, had a lot of good fortune out on the film festival circuit. And now it's out for everyone to see on 7 streaming platforms, 10 cable networks, Amazon Prime, Apple TV Plus, you know, really almost any platform that you have, it's on right now, available for rent or on demand.
Well, and you have to be so happy that this has generated so much buzz and has earned this wide array of awards. I mean, in a crowded field, the world is full of wonderful documentaries, but this has really garnered some notice. That has to make you feel good, and Ike Riley, of course, as well.
It is definitely gratifying, and I say this, I'm you know, I'm not a totally young man, so if I don't know what I'm doing at this point in my career, no, I shouldn't be making stuff. So I knew he was that good. I've done enough to know good source material, and he's great. He's fascinating. And the thing I definitely wanted for this film was his family. His family is amazing. It's relatable. It's the reason why you, Greg, are so partly drawn to this, even though you're not a rock and roll guy.
Right.
You probably, as a lot of people have told us, I'm so enamored with him as an artist and just a human who's trying to go after who he is authentically as an artist. And it doesn't matter what his art form is, that's what he's doing. And, you know, he's bumping up against friends and really family. And he's got an amazing family. He married his high school sweetheart. He's got four kids, you know, and they are one of the most close-knit, unique, welcoming families that you've ever met. And honestly, his band and those around him are just another ring of family for him. Mm. It's kind of like once you're in his world, you're in his world and you get to live there.
Right.
And it's a fun place to be.
Of course. And partly because everybody that we hear from in this film is a great communicator, including Ike Riley himself, but also all of these people around him, including members of his family and the guys in his band and writers and critics who are great admirers. I mean, they all just speak so well and tell this story so effectively. I should think one of the big challenges is to just sort of make sense of it all. I mean, it's one thing to have a mountain of resources in terms of film archive and so on to draw upon, but then it's your job to make a coherent film out of it, which I think you've really done. How big a challenge was that in terms of kind of making sense of this man and his sort of curious career and shaping all of this material into something that would make a strong and clear statement?
Definitely tricky given the volume of footage and just the volume of work. I mean, he's recorded so many songs. I think we jammed around 62 songs or super small parts of into the film. And this is where I will say my secret weapon is Michael O'Brien. Because he's an editor and we've worked together for so long, and then he's got a friendship with Ike and, frankly, a knowledge of his work that goes encyclopedically back decades. So what a leg up I had in him, because he knew him as an artist, he knew his work, he even knew what was there. And so the way we kind of approached it, we knew that there were songs that put a little love in it. It's one of the very first songs you hear. In that song, you hear his process as a songmaker, but you also learn he was a grave digger. You learn that he lost a very close friend of high school friend of his at a very young age as a teenager in an auto accident. So you learn a lot about him as a character through the music. And so we kind of use the music as these mileposts, although we don't go linearly in the film with intent. We don't go linearly.
Right.
We kind of hop around a little bit.
And I got to say, I'm not always a fan of that. I mean, because I think it's very easy to do that in a way that's really kind of confusing and leaves the viewer bewildered. But I think you've done it quite expertly, and I think it works fantastically well. I just love the way the film is shaped. And one of the things that is said again and again by Ike Riley's many admirers who we hear from in this film is that there is something so deeply personal and also authentic about the songs that he has written, and that they really spring out of his life and experience in a way that is sometimes true with other singers, but there's something, it seems like it's exceptionally the case with Ike Riley in terms of where his songs come from and the way in which they are just an authentic part of him.
Absolutely. He really is very talented at exactly what you just described, and that is, you know, doing authentic and different. It's not like he repeats himself musically, lyrically, or even with the types of stories he tells. He is varied in his approach, both in the storytelling and the music. And that's what's exciting as a fan, right? You're anxious to hear what's kind of next. And his world just kind of keeps expanding, you know.
And, of course, you've already talked about his sons and the fact that this is now a family affair of sorts. And I think one of the most remarkable things is what you capture in terms of the interaction, the chemistry between father and sons, and the squabbles that sometimes erupt and so on. Just say a word about what it's like to be present and wanting to capture events without affecting them, in a sense. I mean, by being present with a camera, so often that kind of changes the way people interact. They feel like they're on stage. Clearly, somehow, you managed to avoid that pitfall.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I will say part of it is comfort level and trust level on their part, and that's why I really can't thank the whole family enough, because it's one thing to put your art out there, your music out there. It's another thing to put your familial relationships out there, right? Like, I don't think all of us would necessarily be so willing to do that. And they really did. And that takes a lot of trust. You know, there's a scene where they'd just come back from the boys' premier performance show up in Minneapolis. And Pete Schneider, who was one of our field producers, who did so much great work on this, just single cam. And he's like, he's in the van, he's everywhere, he's in their house. And there's the real conversation. It's like Kevin's flying through the room. Kara's talking to Ike and Shane, and he's just there. And you can tell it's a real conversation, and nobody's faking it, because Pete knows them, and he does such a good job of really kind of, you know, camouflaging into the wall almost. And it's like he's not there. It's like it's just, this is life. We just got back from the road. We're telling you about the show. We're all excited. This is what's happening, and the audience can feel that. They can feel when something's staged and when something's not. And, I mean, we had a lot of footage to draw from, but it's worth getting a lot of footage to get those moments that are real.
Mm. Well, I think real is a great word, of course, for Ike Riley and for his whole band, for his family, and for this wonderful film that people have a chance to view on the big screen this Friday evening at Carthage College at 7 p.m. And Mike Schmieder, I so appreciate you taking the time to talk with me about this film. Congratulations on it and on all the awards that it has earned. And we wish you well with all of your future projects.
Thanks so much. Look forward to seeing everybody out at the Campbell Student Union on Friday. Appreciate it, Greg. Take care.
It's exactly 8:27, and you're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And much more to the point, I am excited to have with me in our studios for the next few minutes for the remainder of today's morning show, Ike Riley himself and two of his sons, Shane and Kevin. Kevin and Mickey. And Ike Riley's three sons, Shane, Kevin, and Mickey, all have been students at Carthage College. Shane is still there. In fact, just broke a...
No, Mickey's here.
Mickey's still there.
That's all right.
I have done my homework, I promise, but it sure doesn't sound like it right now. So Mickey is still there, and Mickey just broke the career soccer scoring title for Carthage. Did I get that right?
Yeah, the goals, yeah.
Very good. So congrats on that, thank you to all three of you for being here in the studios to finish out today's morning show here on WGTD. I should say that Ike Riley and his two sons have just been listening to this interview along with the rest of you, this interview with Mike Schmieder talking about this film, Don't Turn Your Back, on Friday night. Ike Riley, what's it like to enjoy this sort of extra level of attention, even after all these years on stage as a really active and popular musician? I bet this feels like a really wonderful new chapter for you.
Yeah, it's exciting that the music will be heard by more people, and you know, it'll broaden the places we can play and make noise. Listening to the Mike talk there was kind of like, you know, being at your own wake, you know. But, yeah, it's been exciting to travel around for these premieres. And, you know, I hope that it does allow us to work in markets we haven't worked in before.
Right. He mentioned the fact that when he came to you with this idea for doing a film, you didn't exactly jump at the chance. I mean, at least to his face, you were skeptical that your story was maybe interesting enough to be treated in this way in a documentary film. What ended up changing your mind about that, or was your mind ever changed about that?
Yeah, I mean, he was relentless. You know, I guess after I kind of spoke to Mike about trying to make a film that really wasn't a typical rock documentary, that went a little deeper, and I think they made a film, he and Mike O'Brien, that was a little more profound about, you know, America, about booze, religion, struggle. You know, it happens to be our kind of personal story, but I think anybody that's ever tried to do anything or is a part of a family or a band can relate to the film, you know.
What was it like? I know that quite a lot of the film is comprised of archival footage from your many years on the road performing and so on, but some of it was newly captured stuff. What was it like to have a cameraman in your home kind of right there, even as you're rehearsing, you're having family times currently?
Kev, you want to take that?
Well, yeah, no. At first it was a little strange, you know, having a camera right in your face all the time, but after a while you just kind of forget that it's even there. And mind you, we've become pretty good friends with the man behind the camera.
Yeah, Pete Schneider. I
mean, he's had to put up with a lot, that's for sure.
Hmm. He was really unobtrusive, though. Like, we didn't even know he was around half the time. Unfortunately, that's how he captured some really bad behavior.
Well, and I suppose that's one of the hallmarks of a really good documentarian, is that they don't allow their presence to kind of change what's going on, especially if they're trying to capture something as authentically as possible. How nervous were you about what this final film was going to look like? Or did you have such trust in Mike that you knew he was going to be faithful to you and your life and your legacy?
I mean, I had some input, you know, you know, I've always been, you know, pretty open about any kind of anything I was up to. So I wasn't too, my wife was really not into it at all. She was the most reluctant participant in the whole thing and the last person they interviewed. She had a lot of reservations about it and probably still does, but, you know, she's going with it. You know, I trusted those guys though, you know.
I think they did an absolutely amazing job. And I want to remind everybody that the reason we're having this conversation today is because this award-winning documentary film, Don't Turn Your Back on Friday Night, is going to be screened this Friday night, the 11th of October, at Carthage College and the Campbell Student Union. And Mike is going to be there, and there's going to be a Q&A after, and then a performance by Ike Reilly and his band.
Well, it's going to be a kind of a stripped-down performance. It's going to be Mickey and Kevin and Shane and I and my bass player, Pete Cimbalo. It'll be kind of a hootenanny style. unfortunately, it's not going to be the full rock and roll show because the auditorium isn't really conducive for that.
Yeah, that would be a little cramped, but I know a lot of people are just incredibly excited about this. Before we go any further, I do have three samples of your music on hand.
Okay.
Just to for folks
just to
listening.
Make sure everyone turns the radio off.
We hope not. We hope not. And I want to just mention that what I have actually on hand to play excerpts from would be Living in the Wrong Time, Put a Little Love in It, or Carradine. So do you have a request of those three?
I like Living in the Wrong Time.
Okay. And you want to say a quick word about this before we hear a little bit from it?
You know, it just features my rip-roaring band, and, you know, it's just about not being able to escape the era you live in.
Hmm. So here it is, a little bit of Living in the Wrong Time with Ike Reilly.
Give it up, come undone now. Give it up, come undone now. You could be living in the wrong place. You could be living with the wrong race. You'll get by with a short sword. You might be praying to the wrong Lord, but you come undone thinking you're living in the wrong time. Tiny bit of dignity, the lady took my home and my family.
you see your baby around Christmas time, you'll get by and you'll be living fine. But you come undone thinking you're living in the wrong time.
Ike Riley and a song that I just love called Living in the Wrong Time. So we have a lot to cover here and not enough time to cover it the way I want to. But one of the things that is interesting about your story, Ike Riley, is that you have lived most of your life in Libertyville, Illinois, and that's where you choose to remain. Tell us about your powerful connection to what is pretty much your hometown. I mean, you were born, I think, adjacent to the Great Lakes Naval Base, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've lived there my whole life. You know, I got married young to Kara. She's from there. My mom's still alive. She lives a couple blocks from me. My wow. daughter and her kids live around the corner. These guys come and go from the city of Chicago to Kenosha. They pass through Libertyville now and then. My studio's there. You know, I stayed there, you know, it's worked out, I guess, for the most part. It was a good place for these guys to grow up.
Oh, for sure. But did you ever feel, I mean, when you really started to get really serious about your music making, how tempted were you to try to head off to Nashville or New York City or Hollywood?
I was always more serious about making the music than making it in music. You know what I mean? I'll spend, you know, illogical amount of time on something that wouldn't get me anywhere career-wise, but if it was satisfying musically, I would chase it around, you know. So I've had, you know, I'm more interested, for better or for worse, in making as much and as good of music as I can, more so than, you know, chasing opportunities for fame.
Right. So you chose to remain in Libertyville, Illinois, not exactly the rock and roll capital of the world, but it's as you said, it's been a great place for you. One of the interesting things that is said in the documentary film is that Libertyville is a pretty conservative community. But somebody says, maybe it's you or otherwise somebody talking about you says, but such communities forge rebels. Do you feel like that's a pretty good summation of your relationship with Libertyville?
Well, I think even with the whole country, you know, if you're you know, you can see hypocrisy everywhere, you know, in every community. So it depends, you know. I think if you have a propensity to you know, view things with a you know, with your eyes open, you know, you can see the cracks in the American dream all around.
For sure.
All around us. So yeah, I mean, I think so. I don't know. I don't think I said that in the film, but I think, you know, any kind of place where there's oppression and closed-mindedness could easily breed rebellion.
Right. And I do remember you saying in the film, I'm pretty sure it's you saying that closed-mindedness or small-mindedness is everywhere. I mean, in any community, you're going to find that, and including Libertyville, Illinois, for all the things that make it a lovely place. There's also these issues, and you certainly speak to those in your music. Growing up, if we'd known you as, for instance, like a high school kid, would we have imagined that this was in your future? I mean, were there signs at that point in time that you were going to be heading down a road like this?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I was more interested in stories and the characters in books and movies than I was in, you know, I loved music. I played the harmonica when I was a kid, but I didn't really pick up the guitar till my 20s or so. Early 20s.
Well, and you were quite an athlete in high school, so I know.
Oh,
that was,
yeah, they're
some
still talking
devotion.
About that. Yeah, I don't know about that.
Well, we hear from one of the most interesting guys in the film is your close friend and family priest, Reverend Matt Foley, who played rugby with you and ran track with you in high school.
Yeah,
and there's
and
a long time connection there.
We've been running around together. I mean, Matt. I think our relationship is the way could be a blueprint for how America could get along. He and I don't agree on almost anything, politically or anything, and we're very, very good friends.
Nice to see.
You know.
So for a long time, you're not a professional musician at all. Your professions include, I guess, grave digger and doormat at a fancy downtown hotel. At what point did you start to get really, really serious about this music thing and devote yourself wholeheartedly to it?
I was always writing, you know, when these guys were little, you know, I mean, even before, when I worked at the hotel as a doorman, which I did for like 13 years, I was fully invested in songwriting. I didn't think, you know, that I would make get a record deal or anything, but then I did get signed by Universal.
At the age of 40.
Yep, and I quit the hotel and been all in ever since, up and down and in and out of it, you know?
Yeah. So I'm curious to hear from your two sons who are with us, Mickey and Kevin. Growing up, what was your awareness of your dad's life as a musician, and when did you start to actually see that for yourselves? And, you know, what did you make of that? That had to be something that not a whole lot of your peers or classmates could share.
Yeah.
This is Mickey.
Yeah, this is Mickey. When I was born, I was already in the new house, the big log cabin that he had, and his first album came out the year I was born.
Mm.
So my whole life, I was used to it, and he was always recording and going on tours, and I was too young to, you know, kind of realize what was going on. And then as I got older, I was in high school, and he would do these house shows where he would have, you know, live music parties, I should say, in our living room. So I'd be, you know, doing homework, he'd be rehearsing out there, and then I would help, you know, set up for it. And it was a really cool experience. Cooler now that I can look back at it and see, you know, footage and realize how unique that was. And, you know, I've never seen that, you know, anybody do that. So it was really cool how he did that. And then being a part of it and performing with him and, you know, seeing footage from the documentary that I couldn't remember and, you know, seeing his career that I just wasn't around for, it was very cool to see. And gives you more motivation and inspiration, you know, to be a musician and be a part of it. And you get a passion behind it, and it's really cool. And I didn't understand, you know, what he was talking about in his lyrics when I was younger. I listened to his music, but I was just too young to realize what was being said and how talented it actually was. And so it's been cool to see the documentary and everyone speak about him. And I'm glad it's out, and it's awesome.
Cool. Glad you're part of it. How about you, Kevin?
Yeah, you know, being a little bit older than Mickey, it was always kind of normal having these bandmates hanging around the house and always some shenanigans going on, whether it's partying.
What a lovely word, shenanigans.
Yeah.
That can cover a lot of ground.
It sure does.
It's pretty vague.
Yeah.
Right,
it's a euphemism for terrible behavior.
Yeah.
Right. And, it was cool growing up. It always felt normal, right? And kind of since this movie has been released, looking back, and I'm like, oh, you know, that is a bit of an alternative upbringing, one might say.
So it was your normal, but you didn't realize, in a sense, how out of the ordinary it was.
Exactly, yeah. And looking back at it, I'm definitely grateful for for that experience, especially, you know, with the crew. It's a great group of guys, the bandmates, and the characters that my dad and his bandmates drag in, whether we want them at the house or not.
Right.
You know, that's just the way it was. So
exactly,
that's pretty neat.
So how much did you, first of all, feel the pull yourselves to be part of your dad's world? I mean, to maybe get on stage and perform, and to any extent did he encourage that, desire that for you, or was it the opposite? Was he kind of hoping you'd pursue other paths? I mean, what did you make of this in terms of whether or not you might someday be part of it?
Yeah, he never put any pressure on us, that's for sure. We've always, you know, been surrounded by music. But I think when COVID hit is when we really started to join as a unit. We were all quarantined together at our place, and we're like, you know, we got nothing better to do than jam out and play. And I'd say that's the beginning.
That's exactly kind of what happened. I mean, they weren't like in bands on their own at the time. Their biggest, I think, talent is their they're uninhibited, you know. So we just start singing. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I would need a half a bottle of whiskey to sing in front of anybody. And these guys are...
That explains a lot, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. I mean, it's not uncommon to, you know, lean on that kind of thing for a performance.
Sure.
These guys, including Shane, were uninhibited and soulful enough to just sing on their own, and it's a great quality to have.
That's,
you know,
cool.
Especially when you see little kids are so uninhibited, and then something happens to them where they clam up, you know, and to have that ability to express yourself and put yourself out there, I think, is a great quality. Now we happen to all sing together, and we got this genetic connection of these, of our voices, that I think is, you know, it's cool to hear. And I love touring with these guys when they're with us. It adds a lot of, to use Kevin's word, a lot of shenanigans and hijinks. But it's cool. Our show has become like a punk rock folk review, and it's been pretty gratifying.
Fantastic. I want to mention that in the film we see a few excerpts from what Kevin was talking about, some of this performing that you did while in quarantine. I mean, sequestered in your home together. I forget, we see the graphic on the screen, and I can't remember what it was. The Ike Riley quarantine hour or something like that.
Yeah, what is it? The Ike Riley family quarantine hour. We still do the show. We call it the family Q hour now. And we do it, you know, maybe monthly online. And it's, you know, that really reached a lot of new people for us.
And that's just right in the house? I mean,
it's in our studio, but it's, you know, it looks like a parlor of a house built in the 20s, because that's what it is.
Sure. That's so cool. I was just to let my classical music world intrude for a second.
Yeah.
I've just gave a lecture about Franz Schubert, this famous German composer from Vienna in the early 1800s, and he had very little money. He lived on his friends' couches a lot and so on, but he's writing all this amazing music. A lot of it was never published during his lifetime, but it would be performed at these things called Schubertiades, and it would be just a bunch of friends getting together in someone's house and jamming on a Sunday
Schubertiades?
Night. Yeah, Schubertiades are what those
That's
were called,
cool.
Named after him. But anyway, so these are like Ike Riley's modern day equivalent of
he
these.
And I got a lot in common.
There you
both
go.
Broke.
Right. Well, and he wrote about 700 songs over his short life, and you've probably written hundreds of songs, I'm guessing, by now.
I think 200 recorded. But.
Wow, amazing. Could we just hear quickly from you about the whole matter of when you write and how you write? I mean, do you have some sort of discipline way of sitting down and writing songs, or is it a little more kind of freewheeling as the lightning strikes? I mean, how does it typically happen for you?
You know, at any given time, I've been doing this so long, I've got a lot of things that are unfinished, but I work daily on you know, pieces of music, you know, songs, you know. I work with my guitar mostly, and I'll, you know, maybe begin with a stream of consciousness, and then when I see something that I can grab onto, I'll develop it from there, you know. But generally, I mean, I've done it a lot of different ways over the years, you know, with I'm always recording it too, with either a old-fashioned tape recorder, or in a studio, or a phone. You know, a voice memo thing, but generally just start hammering it out with a guitar or piano.
Right.
It's usually the melody probably already exists in my head, and then if some lyrical thing strikes me, I'll kind of suss it out from there.
Right. So for many years, you were quite an active composer, but not so much a performer, right?
Yeah, and sometimes when you're out performing, you can't work. I don't have time to write. Although I do write on the road a lot too.
Right.
At least, you know, come up with some ideas.
All of the footage that I've seen just makes you look like such a natural on stage. Like that's where you were born to be, and it's always sort of intriguing to think about somebody who's doing this thing they seem like they were born to do, and yet. In a sense, it took you a long time to get there. It took you a long time to get on the stage.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I was on a stage doing poorly for a long time. You know, I'm comfortable now on stage, but you know, I've played in bars for a long time. You know, even before, you know, in the '80s. You know, '80s, '90s. Then I stopped for a long time, and kind of kicked it up again in the around the turn of the century.
Right.
So, yeah, I am really comfortable on stage. I like to play with, I love to play with my band, and I like to make a connection with an audience.
Right. You know? And of course we see that with our own eyes in the film. I mean, there's just great footage, and we just see the electricity that's flowing. We also see several instances, as happens especially when you play in bars and other, you know, places like that, there are moments when you're being heckled by somebody in the audience and giving it right back to them, and that's also, it's a different kind of electricity, I suppose, but that's also part of what makes live performance kind of amazing and sometimes,
yeah, I mean, that's
scary.
The kind of thing they put in the film, you know. I think I lose it somewhere on somebody, but you know, that was alcohol fueled, and I gave up that for the time being.
It hasn't stopped him from heckling back, though, that's for sure.
That's right. And maybe heckling his sons from time to time.
I'll heckle these jokers.
Absolutely. I'm curious about each of you, the two sons that are with us. We have Mickey and Kevin in the studios. What were your very first musical explorations? And were they very much kind of like in concert with your own dad or in other ways? Kevin, let's start with you.
Well, like, you mean as an artist?
Okay. Well, right. Or I mean, do you play the flute when you were a little kid or whatever? Or,
you know, I played the recorder in first grade for a little while. No, but other than that,
do you mean that there are explorations like in the music that influenced them, or?
Or just, maybe even more just as musicians
as
yourselves.
As musicians, yeah. Well, for my 18th birthday, I got my first guitar, and that's when I, you know, first started, I guess, playing my own music and singing and writing a few songs. But I mean, it didn't really take off, I will say, until 2020 when we started working as a unit, and that inspired me a lot more because, you know, just being a part of something that sounds good and feels good, it's like, all right, well, I want to continue to pursue this at some degree.
Makes sense. How about you, Mickey?
Yeah, I would mess around on the guitar when I was in like middle school and high school. And I would say, yeah, late high school is when, Even early high school, he would have me record, you know, me singing on, you know, his records and stuff like that.
Me too, Kev.
Yeah.
You guys were singing on, doing backup vocals years ago.
Yeah, like when we were younger. So I was around music and in the studio, and I would see the process. And then, I would say COVID is when I started performing in front of people and actually putting in the time to rehearse. And then I was playing more and more guitar. And now I'm at the point where I'll play every day, and I'll do my own sets at some bars in Kenosha, and just to practice and, you know, live perform. And so, yeah, I'm starting to go down that path a little bit. But, yeah, that was probably the when it got serious was COVID.
Yeah. Well, nice that there were a few silver linings from something so awful, and that's one of them, at least as far as the Riley family's concerned. So there's a really dramatic and wonderful moment in the film towards the very end when all three of you are on stage. I think it's at a famous venue up in the Twin Cities, if I remember correctly. And tell us about that really special night.
What these guys were just talking about was their, you know, entry into, you know, being performers. And so we had started to work on doing some songs together, and then we ended up at the First Avenue. We play at the First Avenue in Minneapolis every Thanksgiving Eve for the past 20 years, probably. Mm. And we had gone through some difficult times as a family, and we headed up to the Twin Cities, and Kevin and Mick and Shane all came out for the first time in front of a packed house with the band and performed on stage. And for me, it was really surreal and special. For my bandmates, it was also really emotional. I don't know if it was as emotional for these guys, but it was a really cool musical moment. I don't think we knew at the time that it was really demarcation of a change in that they would be touring with us for the next, you know, few years and being included on albums. And it was, I think the way the film captures that moment is probably a little bit more poetic than what I just rambled on about. But it was weird, you know, to be in a familiar venue that, and then to look to your left and right and see
your own sons.
Yeah, your kid. Yeah, and kind of our greasy rock and roll band, you know. But you know, my band knew these guys since they were born.
Of course.
And my bandmates were really welcoming, and they were also moved by it. Still, we're doing show. When we did our premiere at the Metro in Chicago, and you know, Tom Morello is the executive producer of the film. He was playing with us. That too was, you know, emotional. You know, I'm with, you know, Tom. This film's coming out. We're at Metro, which was a club that I, you know, have played in for years. And then to look over and I look at these guys as my bandmates, and then I have to realize, wow, those are my kids too.
Mm-hmm. So absolutely, that life doesn't get much better than
and
that.
And I think people are moved by that as well, audience, you know, people that come to see us.
Absolutely, as well they should be. By the way, one of your sons, I don't remember if it's one of the two that are sitting here in the film, says, my dad is a hothead and a perfectionist. Do you, either of you remember saying
yeah,
that?
I think that is, yeah.
So this is something Kevin said.
I'll show you hothead.
So you better say something sweet about him now in our closing minute.
I wish I had something sweet to say about him.
just kidding. He's an ingrate.
No, yeah. He's, you know, it's a hell of a heck of a relationship. So, excuse me. Yeah.
We're pretty, you know, we have volatile relationships with one another where nothing lasts very long.
Yeah,
we move on.
The squabbles, you mean?
Yeah.
You should have seen us last night. We were getting after it, but then we woke up this morning. It's like, all right, I'll pick you up at 7. Let's shoot up to Kenosha. So.
And talk on the radio.
We got a couple more fights before lunch that are coming.
Oh yeah. Boy. Okay, Mickey, how about you? What is your weighing in as the youngest son on all of the crazy, wonderful excitement of being part of this this family?
I don't mind being the youngest. A lot of people say that, you know, I'm a spitting image of him, my dad. I don't know how I feel about that, but it's definitely a good compliment to say that I reflect some of the things he does, but it's nice being the youngest and having the brothers, you know, be there for me in terms of like coaching me musically, and especially Shane gives me a lot of good input on just, you know, how to be around people and how to be professional about music and learning from him. He doesn't say much and kind of just expects, you know, things to be perfect and right away, and Shane's kind of a good coach, I would say.
Or a buffer.
Yeah,
that's what you're saying.
Yeah,
Shane's written a bunch of great songs. He's a little, he's got an album coming out. But, sorry to interrupt, Mick.
No, yeah. Go for it.
This is great. Well, you've taken us down a really fun family journey, your personal and professional journey, and the way in which your three sons, as well as your daughter and wife and all these close friends, have all been a part of this remarkable journey. This film, speaking of remarkable, is remarkable as well. Don't Turn Your Back on Friday night. It's going to be screened at Carthage College in the Campbell Student Union this Friday night at 7 p.m. with a Q&A afterwards, and then a performance that will feature Ike Riley and all three of his sons, Mickey and Kevin, in the studio today. Shane will be joining in the fun as well. That is Friday night, free and open to the public. It should be a really, really exciting night. And I want to thank all three of you for getting up bright and early to join me on the morning show today. It's been really, really great to talk with all of you, and I wish you only the very, very best in all that stretches ahead for you. Ike, Kevin, and Mickey Riley.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you very much.
Good to have you here. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.